So the sutta I chose to work with tonight is the Kula Dhamma Samadana Sutta. Don't ask me to say that twice, please. And this is that roughly translates as the shorter discourse on the way of undertaking things. And I've subtitled this whole talk, "More Suffering or More Happiness?" Question mark. And this is really the basic question of the whole practice. Do you want more suffering or do you want more happiness? I mean, there's that classic quote that the Buddha is attributed to the Buddha, where he says, "I teach only suffering in the end of suffering." That's what this is all about. And in this particular sutta, has sort of a what we'll call a classical form. You see this in several other suttas as well, and in several other forms of philosophical discourse for that matter. And basically, what happens is there's two things, and then those two things can have, combine in essentially four different ways, and each of those four different ways is something we should look at. And it's pretty standard way of presenting ideas to make sure we're thorough and look at it from all angles, that we're not sort of stuck on just one particular view of things, saying, "Oh, well, this could be this, it could be that," and it sort of it makes us think. And let me read the key verse here from the sutta. And this is the second verse here. "Bhikkhus, there are four ways of undertaking things. What are the four? There's the way of undertaking things that is present now and ripens in the future as pain. There's a way of undertaking things that is painful now and ripens in the future as pain. There's a way of undertaking things that is painful now and ripens in the future as pleasure. There's the way of undertaking things that is pleasant now and ripens in the future as pleasure." So you see, we've got pleasant now, pleasant later. And then it's either pleasant or unpleasant. So we got the combination gives us four possibilities. And these are four different ways, in a sense, of how our life unfolds in various times, and that's why it's called the way of undertaking things. The actual sutta, the shorter discourse on the way of undertaking things. And the interesting thing is this: these four things, pleasant to start, painful in the end, painful to start, painful in the end, painful to start, pleasant in the end, pleasant to start, pleasant in the end, very closely parallel another classic set of four, which is the four forms of right effort. So I want to speak about this sutta in that context, the teachings on right effort, the sixth step in the Eightfold Path, because they're very interrelated, those two things. So let's start at the beginning. Pleasant to start, painful in the end. Pretty good description of normal life is what I wrote. It's like our whole culture encourages us to indulge in things that are pleasant now. That's what it's all about. Let's find something pleasant and have that. And then let's find another pleasant thing and have that. But often, the result isn't so pleasant. It might actually end up being painful. We indulge in a lot of fatty food and we drink lots of alcohol and smoke cigarettes, and sure enough, all of a sudden, at some stage in your life, like my uncle who was 52, you have a massive heart attack. Just because you don't, it's like it was all about the pleasant. And it didn't, you didn't realize where it was going. You know. And it's simple in a way. I mean, there's this phrase I love to mention at this point. It said, a moment on the lips, a lifetime on the hips. This is like, this describes what we're talking about actually quite well. You know, it's that moment of pleasure. My favorite kind of chocolate or whatever, you know, whatever your addiction is. And then we deal with the results of that in our body. This is also true on the mental level. When I'm talking, I talk about eating things and that, but also on the mental level, we are constantly consuming things. In this age of the internet and all the various things like Facebook and Instagram and the endless, it's endless, right? It's so easy to end up consuming a lot of stuff, mentally consuming, that might be even be pleasant at the moment. It's kind of cool to read about. I mean, if you're me, I'm a politics junkie, I'll be honest with you. I'd love to read political stuff. And look, what did he do today? And, you know, oh my God. And then I can just feel myself getting wound up. And I'm going, why am I consuming this? I know how I'm going to vote in November the 3rd. That's not going to change. But I, at the same time, it's like, well, I want to sort of keep current. And I think there's some value to that. But it's like, it's so easy to overindulge, to consume more of that than is healthy. And just we end up being wound up all the time. Not skillful. So this is I want to actually read something from Joseph Goldstein here. This is from his book Mindfulness. And he's talking about this aspect of right effort. This aspect of right effort points to a fundamental understanding of how our mind works. In the suttas, the most pragmatic description of nibbana, realization, is the mind that is free from the root defilements of greed, hatred, and delusion. We've all experienced many wholesome mind moments when these defilements are not present, yet have also had unwholesome factors frequently reemerge as conditions change. This is the functioning of what are called latent defilements, mind states that are not present in the moment, but have the potential to arise whenever the conditions for them to reappear are present. It is just this understanding that can inspire a feeling of spiritual urgency. When we're leading basically good and wholesome lives, it's easy to become complacent about our present circumstances. But under these favorable conditions, we still have many moments when greed, hatred, and delusion arises. We see something beautiful and we want it. Our mind is pulled towards it. Or perhaps we see somebody doing something we don't like. Oh, it's pretty common these days, right? Seeing something we don't like and the mind is suddenly filled with judgment and aversion. Or we may be tired and the mind simply dulls out in delusion. So the first of the four great endeavors is recognizing that the enduring power of these latent defilements, understanding that what gives rise to them and preventing them from rising and taking hold. So this is, in a sense, this is a definition of the first kind of right effort. You know, doing what we can to prevent the arising of unwholesome states of mind. Doing what we can to prevent the arising of unwholesome states of mind. It's like, I know if I read the entire New York Times, by the end of reading the entire New York Times, especially all the political stuff, I'm going to be riled up. I know that. So I know I don't need to do that. I can read, I'll read this one today about, you know, what's going on in Texas or something, because it's kind of interesting, you know, keeping current, but not, don't consume the whole, don't eat the whole pie at once, because then you'll have a bellyache, right? Same sort of thing. So it's like, we get to know ourselves, and we get to see where, how our mind gets sucked in. And we go, I don't need to go there. This is a conscious choice we can make. Okay, so then the second piece. Painful to start and painful in the end. This is a good description. And this is my notes here. A good description of those habits we have that we know cause us and others suffering, but we continue with them anyway. And this is because they're just like these habitual patterns that we get, we every time we go there, they cause suffering for ourselves. And often because they're causing suffering for ourselves, we often then express that suffering out in the world and cause suffering for others. And this is also a really good description of what it's like to be addicted. This is addiction. This is like, it's painful at the time, and it's painful in the end. This is how, what happens to people who are addicted. They live in this life where they're caught in this painful cycle, but they keep repeating the same thing. No. I love this quote. Insanity is repeating the same action over and over again, expecting a different result. Right? This is what we're talking about here. Here's this thing. It's painful when we do it. It's unwholesome. We see the results, and we do it anyway. And we do it again, and we do it again, and we do it again, thinking somehow it's going to work out different. It's not going to be painful in the end anymore. But it always is. So this is the second form of right effort. You know, when a wholesome, unwholesome mind state has arisen, do what you can to end it. So we see ourselves falling, if we're mindful. This is the value of mindfulness. This is why we practice mindfulness. Because mindfulness allows us to see, oh, here I am going there again. Here I am caught in this one again. You know, it's like the mind is just like this. Things arise in the mind. And it's I love the image of a baited hook. And the bait goes by, and the bait looks really juicy, and we bite down, right? Duh. And of course, what happens is we bite down, and then we get caught with the hook, and the hook's in our jaw, and it's really painful. And we're flopping around, caught yet again by this thing that was just floating by, that we could have gone, I know I don't need to do that. I know I can feel already the energy of that. I can feel the unwholesomeness of it before I even bite down. But then I bite down anyway, over and over and over again sometimes. And so when that happens, when we see these unwholesome mind states have arisen, then the skillful thing to do is to do what we can to actually end them. And all of a sudden now, here I am contradicting pretty much everything that's taught at the beginner level in mindfulness training. You know, mindfulness typically says, you know, whatever's arising, that's what's arising. And that's true up to a point. But in this practice, at a certain point, oh, that's arisen again. That same old story, that every time I tell myself that story, I just get upset. There's the pain again. There's the sorrow again. There's the sadness again. There's the anger again. There's the, you know, strong, unwholesome emotional states arising. I've looked at it. I've very carefully paid attention to it. I've done all the things I'm supposed to do. And now here it is again. And now it's skillful to go, I don't need to hang out with this anymore. There is a great sutta that talks about various ways to deal with things, but I don't want to go into a great detail with that tonight, but maybe some other night I'll teach that sutta. But I do want to read what Joseph has to say here, because Joseph says it, of course, very clearly. And he's talking about this, these unwholesome things that arisen as the hindrances, you know, those things that get in the way of us being clear and connected to the present moment. At times, though, the hindrances may be tenacious, and we need additional strategies for abandoning them. In one sutta, that's the one I'm talking about, the Buddha describes 5 techniques for dispelling distracting thoughts and unwholesome mind states. The first of these is just its opposite as an antidote. For example, if ill will has arisen, we can refocus the mind on metta, on loving kindness. So there we are thinking about someone, whether it's, you know, someone we know or just someone, some politician or some who knows. And we see our mind full of ill will. And it's, if you can, you just shift the mind to think, you know, may you be safe, may you be happy, may you be healthy, may you, like, actually offer them metta. And if that's not possible, because in some cases these people, our reactions are so strong and so sometimes so deeply embedded, it's difficult to even, we choke on the words, then at least form the intention to one day be able to offer them metta. That's because it's the intention that's important. Okay, I'll continue with Joseph here. Or if restlessness is present, calming the mind through calming the breath can be helpful. So just there I am, I'm sort of all wired and fidgety. Often when I'm in that mindset, especially in my sitting practice, what I'll do is I'll do what's called breath counting, where I'll inhale, I'll exhale, and I'll count backwards from 10, because it takes a lot more concentration. So I'm restless, I can't focus, so I intentionally choose a practice that forces me to really concentrate and focus. This can be very skillful. This is called skillful means, right? Or if envy or jealousy is strong, we can turn the mind to feelings of mudita, empathetic joy. So we see someone who's having a great time and, you know, or has like, oh, it's not fair that they're so happy and I'm not, I'm miserable, blah, 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 blah. We all go there. And instead, we just turn to mudita, which is you find happiness, your happiness arises because someone else is happy. See if you can find that space. So this is just, you know, this unwholesome mind state has arisen and we just shift the mind, consciously shift it. So I'll read a bit more of this. The second means for removing unwholesome states already arisen is through the factors of hiri and otapa, often translated respectively as self-respect and respect for the wise. These wholesome factors of mind bring a heightened sense of conscience and responsibility. Reflecting on how the wise might view an unwholesome mind state or activity is often a powerful ally in this endeavor to abandon what is unwholesome. For this reason, these factors are called the guardians of the world. And then there's a little yellow flag warning here. Care is also needed here so that this review of our actions is done from a place of wise understanding and is not simply feeding into patterns of self-judgment or guilt. But used wisely, hiri and otapa can awaken us from the power of deluded thinking. So it's like, it's not like just, oh, I know this is wrong. I can see, I know from the teachings, from my teachers, from the best parts of our culture, that this is not a wholesome thing to do. maybe I shouldn't go there. It's really a skillful shifting of the mind. So both of these are ways, and it goes on with other, in that sutta, there's other ways to shift the mind too, but those are the two that I find most interesting. And remember, in mindfulness practice, we got to, the other thing we have to be careful for is we don't sort of go, when these things arise, these unpleasant things arise, I'm supposed to do something about them. Because then it can become a very subtle way of what's called spiritual bypassing and aversion. It's just a way of going, oh no, I'm holy, I only ever have holy thoughts, I'm so pure, I should never have thoughts like this, so I'm just not going to ever have those thoughts. Well, I'm sorry, you're a human being and you're going to have those thoughts, I guarantee you. It's good to look at them, it's skillful to look at them. And the other thing is, for all of these mind states, the first and the most important antidote for all these mind states is mindfulness. Because if you see an unwholesome mind state arising, some old story that you tell yourself over and over again or whatever, some fantasy. If you're mindful of that as it's going on, if you can see it for what it is, this is just stuff that's arisen in my mind. Now the unwholesomeness is sort of erased, in a sense, because now you're just being mindful of what's arising. It isn't, you might be mindful of how unpleasant it feels. You might be mindful of the actual story and the ridiculousness of it. And you might even laugh at yourself. It's very skillful to laugh at yourself. And then it's just part of the practice. This is, all these unwholesome mind states just become things that are part of the practice. They're not bad. They're just stuff. And if we see them as just stuff, then they lose their power. If we can be actually being mindful, even though we might not be able to turn off that story because it's so habitual and it runs, it's like I can watch the story, but instead of being caught in the story and flopping around, now I'm just watching that baited hook float down the stream, and oh yeah, I know that baited hook, and that's okay, and yeah, there it is. I can sort of feel the temptation to bite down, but I'm aware of it, and now it's just being mindful of what's happening. This is what's arisen. What's predominant in my mind right now is this. This is what I'll pay attention to. Now I'm just being mindful of it, not caught by it. Two different, very different things. Moving on. We're getting to the good stuff now. Painful to start, pleasant in the end. My notes here says, this is a very good description of what practice is like sometimes. Sometimes practice is difficult. Our practice, this is not an easy thing we're choosing to do. Practice can be difficult, very difficult. I mean, things kind of rise in the mind and it's like, oh my God. And if we can work with them skillfully, it might be quite painful, quite difficult. I mean, I've certainly had, on long retreats, had days where I just was like a basket case most of the day, just fall apart. And that's normal. There's nothing wrong with that. You're not being bad or unskillful. It's like you're letting in that stuff that we've shoved away all our lives and really looking at it. And it can be quite painful, but then at some point it's like, now that thing, whatever it was, that old memory, that old story, that old fantasy, doesn't have its power anymore. It's not painful anymore. It's kind of, and that sense of that relief is quite pleasant because the mind goes still. When we really look at this stuff, the mind actually goes still. which is incredibly pleasant. But we've accepted the fact that it's painful now, and yet this is not going to be very nice. This is going to be ugh, as a matter of fact. But otherwise, we just keep, you know, that's unpleasant, and aversion arises, and we push it away. And then it just comes back again anyway, and again, and again. So we have to sort of understand that these unpleasant things that we experience in practice are part of the practice. You know, people have this idea that meditating is all about just being blissful and, you know, sitting on the mountain with a big smile on your face, right? No, actually, practice can sometimes be very difficult. But the wholesomeness that arises out of working skillfully with what arises that's difficult is very powerful. I'll give you a personal example. It's on one of my longer retreats. And at a certain point, 3-4 weeks into the retreat, so I was fairly deep, quite concentrated, I started having these very, very vivid experiences. They were almost like, I suppose you could call them hallucinations, but they weren't, but they were like mental experiences of either me dying or my wife dying. Over and over and over, this is what I was experiencing. And at the time I was experiencing these things, they were extremely painful because I was actually caught in the energy of what it would be like. I mean, I'd be sitting there or lying in bed and my wife would be sitting in the chair beside me as I died, or vice versa. And the pain involved in experiencing that over and over and over again was just unbelievable for me. But it was like a real insight out of all this was that, yeah, this is true. You know, this is an insight into the truth of suffering. If you're in relationship with someone, one of you is going to die first. It's going to be unpleasant for you, the person who's dying, and really unpleasant for the person who's sitting there watching, or vice versa. No matter how you look at it, that's built in to any long-term relationship is its ending, whether it's through death or through other means. That's the nature of relationship, has built right into it. And we can't avoid it. We cannot possibly avoid that. And to see that so clearly, to literally experience it over and over and over again, was a very powerful thing. Wasn't pleasant in the beginning, but the steadiness of mind, the calmness that came out of those experiences, and my sort of acceptance of that reality, I suppose, is quite, I don't know if the word is pleasant, but it's quite steadying. So I suppose steadying is another way of saying pleasant. And that's the nature of practice. Sometimes it will be really unpleasant. And we just have to learn to be okay with that. Because what often happens is people get into this practice and it's pleasant and it's kind of cool and interesting. And then they hit a patch like this, where it's like just like train wreck time. And if you're not careful, this is when people walk away from the practice. This stuff isn't fun anymore. This is when we have to really buckle down and pay attention and really be mindful, because this is when the real learning happens often in these difficult times. Okay. So this is the third form of right effort, by the way. Doing what we can to encourage wholesome mind states to arise. So yeah, I'm going to sit there and practice and do this difficult thing, knowing that in the end, a wholesome mind state is going to arise. So I'm going to have to accept the difficulty, the unpleasantness, in the beginning because it's going to be pleasant in the end. It's going to be very powerfully pleasant in the end. Door number four. This is a really good one, right? Pleasant to start, pleasant at the end. This is also a description of what practice is like sometimes. I mean, there are times when practice is just sweet, incredibly sweet. And you all know this. You know that, you know, that there's that time where you sit and it's just like at the end of the sitting period, you know, and you know, the bell rings or your little timer goes, whatever it is, however you know to stop or whatever, you stop. And it's like, your mind is just clear and calm and still, and your body is just relaxed, and it's like, this is beautiful. Either at the after you, or even while you're practicing now, you're experiencing that. There's just that, you know, that sweetness and that clarity when you're really still and focused and calm. That just. And we have to acknowledge these times. And we have to actually accept the fact that we're capable of being happy in this way. That just sitting and practicing, just doing our practice. I shouldn't say just sitting because it could be walking. It happens to be with walking practice as well, or other forms of practice for that matter. But practice can bring us these times of just like, real sweetness. It's pleasant while I'm practicing, pleasant in the end. This is just, it's natural. This is the fourth form of right effort. When a wholesome mind state has arisen, we should do what we can to preserve that wholesome mind state. So there you are. You've just sat, you're in this calm, still space. Not a good time to turn on your computer and read the news. Let's just maybe go pull some weeds in the garden or go for a walk. Just let's do what we can to preserve that energy a little longer, if we can. That's very skillful practice, just to choose not to sort of immediately get caught up again in things. Just to go, I'm just going to. And we have to watch the mind here, because what often happens is it's like, oh, I shouldn't be this happy. You know, the world's going to hell in a handbasket. How can I be this happy? You know, it's not right. There must be something wrong with me. I'm not paying enough attention. Don't go there. Just enjoy it. You know, enjoy that the sweetness that arises. And it could be like, you know, it isn't even necessarily practice. You could be just, you know, you go outside to get in your car and you notice that the sky is sort of has that, you know, sometimes Boulder has these amazing skies, you know, with the clouds and the colors, and it's like, and you just sort of go, you sort of stand there and just look at the sky. Let yourself stand there. So you're going to be a little late getting to where you're supposed to go, and maybe you're, you know, right? Who cares? Just take it in. Take in the beauty that's all around us all the time. We often don't let ourselves do that. We're too busy. Just take it in. You know, we have a big garden and we have a lot of birds. And often after dinner, what we do is we sit and just watch the birds. It's like we say, this is our movie. You know, it's like the birds at the bird feeder flitting around. And the birds happen. I don't know if you know this, but sparrows really like chard and kale. And one of the sparrows will sit on top of the charred leaves and the kale, and just chow down on them. And it's like, okay, that it's sort of kind of cute, you know? They sort of sway and back and forth on the charred leaves, and it's just so, it's kind of sweet and pleasant. So we just, okay, so that leaf, I may not get all of it. I'll just get part of it when I'm and that's okay. So it's like you just sort of take things in as you see them and allow that to happen. Okay. So this is underlined in my notes here. It's important that you enjoy your practice. If this practice becomes a task, often sometimes a grim task, oh, I have to go sit again, sigh, then it's not going to be, you're not going to last that long. You have to let that joy that arises, take it in, acknowledge it, and as you know, when a wholesome mind state has arisen, we should do what we can to preserve that wholesomeness. Take it in and enjoy it. And acknowledge that it's okay. There's nothing wrong with feeling happy, feeling joyful, feeling calm. These are wonderful, wholesome mind states. And we should accept them, acknowledge them, encourage them as much as we can. So that's what I want to say about this sutta. There is another interesting sutta I want to mention. Also from Majjhima Nikaya. This is called Vanapata Sutta. It's jungle thickets. And this is similar in structure to the other one. I want to read a little bit of this just so you can get a sense of it. And you'll see where the parallels are here. Here, bhikkhus, a bhikkhu lives in some jungle thicket. While he is living there, his unestablished mindfulness does not become established. His unconcentrated mind does not become concentrated. His undestroyed taints do not come to destruction. He does not attain the unattained supreme security from bondage, and also the requisites of life that should be obtained by one gone forth. Robes, alms food, resting place, medical requisites are hard to come by. The bhikkhu should consider thus, I'm living in this jungle thicket where things aren't going well, basically. Time for me to find another place to practice. And then the sutta goes on and he talks about, so here we got these two things. Is my practice succeeding? And do I have the requisites? Do I have the requisites from a bhikkhu's point of view, like I said, with alms food, robes, medicine, and a good place to practice, a hut or something? And these two are being held in balance. Is the practice, quote, succeeding? By succeeding, you know, am I making progress in my practice? Am I tending towards nibbana? And what's the situation of the problem? So the four options were not succeeding, poor requisites. Time to go. Go find a better place to practice. Right? Not succeeding, good requisites. So you have all the comforts you need. But practice isn't going anywhere. Time to go. Time for a change. And then the other two are, of course, succeeding. Poor requisites. In other words, the practice is going really, really well, but you're struggling to just get the basics of life. Keep practicing just like you are. And then succeeding, good requisites. Wow. This is a no-brainer, right? We're going to stay there for sure. And the reason I mention this sutta is it sort of is a reflection of how our lives. I mean, we have our requisites are a bit more complicated. You know, we have to, you know, pay the mortgage and pay the rent, and we have to pay the payments on the car and our medical insurance costs, and you know, people aren't going to bring us food every day. We got to go buy food and deal with, you know, we have to deal with all that stuff of being a householder. But what we have to be careful of is we get so focused on getting all that stuff because our culture encourages us to get more and more and more of it, that our practice is not succeeding. Getting all that stuff is getting in the way of having time to practice, to take the practice seriously. And that's something we just have to actually consciously, as householders, pay attention to, because it's so easy in our culture, right, where we're taught that the whole object of our lives is to consume, to get more stuff, that we put so much time and energy into getting more stuff and making money so we can get more stuff. And because we're making money, we have to do a job, and that job, we have to go there and we have to do the job, and that takes a lot of time, and there's not much vacation time left over, and blah, 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 blah. You know, life is getting in the way of my practice. And we have to go and look at that. And the flip side is, on the other end, if your practice is going great right now, and I'm sure that's true for some of you, for sure, though that comes and goes like everything else, but you're sort of struggling to sort of get by in life, stick with the practice part. More practice. Stick with the practice. And don't worry so much about the life stuff. That's what this sutta is saying. And if your practice is going well and you have everything you need, you're living in, you're content with what you have and the practice is going well, two thumbs up. Good for you. And just be, hopefully it'll stay the way, but be honest with you, we probably won't, because life is going to change. That's the nature of things. The interesting thing about the sutta is it goes through these four things about, you know, bhikkhus in jungle thickets. Then the sutta repeats itself for bhikkhus who are practicing in a particular village, a particular town, a particular city, a particular country, or dependent on a particular person. Like some bhikkhus would stay because some prince or some rich merchant was supplying all the requisites for them all the time. Doesn't make any difference. So you've got this cushy place where you're staying and they have a really nice hut for you to live in and all that stuff is there, but your practice is not going anywhere. Time to leave cushy land and go out. And so we have to think about what both these suttas are really saying with regard to our lives as householders. And one is that it's really important that from time to time, we sort of step back a little bit and look at our life and our practice and honestly go, how's it going? Am I just caught in my, oh, this is how I've always practiced and things are, you know, is there enough effort here? Is there enough right effort here? Is there enough wholesome effort? Or am I sort of spinning my wheels? Being careful not to turn this into a judgment pity party event, which is very easy to do as well. But just to honestly sort of step back and go, yeah, I mean, what else can I do? Can I do more? Can I practice more? You know, I'm about to say, can I go on retreat more? Well, right now, of course, not much happening in retreat land, unfortunately. Touch wood, it'll all happen. This time next year, we'll all be talking about the great retreats are going on. So, but for now, but it's like, and then in, so that's one level of like being able to step back and actually look and see, you know, am I succeeding, not succeeding? Am I caught up loving my requisite so much they're getting in the way? The earlier situation, you know, where we're talking about, it's pleasant to start, And I like the pleasant, but it's painful in the end. Not, I have to look and say, is that a pattern I've fallen into? But I have to sort of step back to take that broader view to see that. Because we're so often just caught on that treadmill of life, of like just living life and doing the same thing because that's what I'm doing. And especially these days, because we're sort of constricted and constrained even more than normal in our lives because of what's going on in the world. I find myself having to be very careful not to just run around on my treadmill, because it's so easy to go, oh, yeah, this is the day I go shopping because I only try and go shopping once a week, and this is the, and you just get caught in that and not stand back and look. So that's one thing that these suttas make me think about. The other thing is, basically what these suttas are both saying is, when we have to make decisions, especially big decisions about our lives, what's going to happen, where are we going to move or not, are we going to change jobs or not, are we going to get into this relationship or not, am I going to end this relationship or not, et cetera, et cetera, all those, you know, life decisions. The key ingredient to making all those decisions has to be, how does that affect my practice? That's what has to be foremost in the decision grid. It may not be the only thing, but it's got to be way up there at the top of the list. How is this decision going to affect my practice? Is this going to lead to more happiness or more suffering? Going back to my original subtitle. That has to be how we make decisions. You know, based on our right understanding, forming right intention, we then act based on that understanding. This choice I'm making leads to me deepening my practice. That's how I make the decision. Or that has more weight in the making the decision than anything else. It can't be, often it won't be the exclusive only thing, but it's an important, very important factor. And it has to be at the top of the list. And that's what these suttas are really talking about. Talking about how we make decisions in the world and how we choose, because we're all choosing all the time, from choosing what we're going to eat for dinner to choosing where we're going to live and who we're going to live with and what job we're going to do and so on. There's all those choices all the time, and we have to factor in this idea of practice as being the important part of that equation, more important than anything else. And then that'll lead skillfully to more happiness, less suffering, more happiness. It'll just be a result of consciously choosing to do that. Okay. So as always, I can't stop without reading a poem. This is again from Dana Fald's book, Go In and In. And this is called A Voice Spoke in the Twilight. And a voice spoke in the twilight, for I will carry you across the wide river of life and see you safely to the other side. Be unafraid and joyous. On this shared journey, you will see miracles. You will know sadness. The heart of your heart will be glad, and at times you will suffer, but there won't be a single moment when you'll stray from the path. If you could only believe that right now, this moment is part of the journey, perhaps you'd see the futility of worry or despair. I will carry you no matter if you find the way easy and safe or rife with danger and impossibility. I will keep you in the presence of God and in the light of truth. This is my covenant with you. I speak soul to soul, and I say only what is true. With that, the night went back to stillness. This is a moment of enlightenment described. That's what I've been talking about. You know, that joyous moment when you go, ah, okay. May the beneficial energies arising from our practice here together today become the causes and conditions for the end of suffering and the awakening of all beings everywhere. Thank you all for coming in and sharing this time with me.
Thank you.
See you all later.
Thank you.
Bye. Oh, thank you. Welcome, Sharon.
Bye.